Access number 30001, it's Peter Est, Real 13. Now, what about the other flight commander? That was Butch Lyons. I don't know if you know his real name, his nicknames, but must be difficult. You always knew him as Butch.
I think it was John.
John. What was he like?
Oh, he was a good chap. He was good. We used to get on very well together. Because we'd both been at Grangemouth together, so we knew each other pretty well. And
he had more operational experience, had he? Not more than you, but I meant than,
yes,
than Alan Johnson.
Yes.
And more maturity.
Yes, yes, certainly. He was Jewish, in fact, but you never think so to look at him, or he never mentioned it, but his family owned the biggest Jewish restaurant in the East End of London. What's the name of a well-known street in the East End?
Petticoat Lane?
Yes, Petticoat Lane, that's it. Yeah. Is it in the book? Yeah.
I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Yeah, that's it. And they had a very big kosher meat butcher's business there. They were well settled. It really was the biggest kosher butcher in the country.
Now you got on another course while you're sort of working up, because that's what's happening. The squadron's working up, isn't it? You go on a course to Loch Fyne. Do you know what that course was?
Oh, I went on the instructor's beach course at Inverary.
Now, what's an instructor's
beach? It only lasted, it was only a five or six day course.
What's an instructor's beach course?
We were on board a boat in the Clyde, and that's where the course was held. It was really, I think, you know, looking ahead to the days when they thought we might be making landings somewhere.
So it's a beach landing.
Yes, yes.
So what's that got to do with the RAF? Do you see what I mean? What did you have to learn?
I think really it was a sort of a joint service thing, so that it wasn't all RAF, and everybody sort of discussed things and learnt things from various the other services. So. I think that was the main point of it, to be quite honest.
So it's sort of combined operations?
Yes, yeah.
And do you remember any of the things you learned? I know in 5 days you probably...
No, not now. They showed us the types of things that one would need to know to land troops, and then the sort of air... We would then cover the sort of air cover that they would be given. And it was... As I say, it was only a 5 day course, so it wasn't long enough to learn very much.
Now, did you know where you were going to?
No.
So, what happened next?
I went back to Euston to 243 Squadron, and I was there for another month, and then they wanted some experienced fighter pilots in the Western Desert, and they wanted about 20, and I was one of the chaps selected to go.
Now, with your squadron or without your squadron?
Oh, without squadron. No, you went. They picked 20 individuals who they thought had the necessary background of experience to be of help to the Desert Air Force.
Now, how did you feel about leaving, what was being your squadron? You were forming it, you were the flight commander.
Yes. Well, you know...
Disappointed or...?
I thought, well, gosh, I haven't been here long, then, and a short time, and now they're moving me on. But no, I didn't mind. From there on, from... the end of July up until about mid-September, I was in transit because I had to go and report to in Scotland. What the hell was it? Anyway, I can't remember.
The ship was called Narconda.
Yes. Yes, that's right, it was.
You were on your way to a Lagos transit.
But of course, yes.
Now, what was the trip like?
Well, you see, it was a huge convoy of ships escorted by a naval patrols, and we didn't go direct to the west coast of Africa. It took off the convoy from Clyde, I suppose it was, in Scotland, and then we went right up to Iceland, and then almost across to America, and then to come back in right down south and come into West Africa from the South Africa, South America, and did that to try to avoid the U-boat. They had a lot of U-boats operating in mid-Atlantic, so we're going around in a big circle to avoid these U-boats.
Now, what was the trip like?
Well, it's a bit boring, to be quite honest. You know, we had quite a few chaps on board.
What were conditions like? I mean, was it comfortable or?
Did
you have your own cabin?
There was loads of people on board, and we in our cabin we had six, all RAF pilots.
How big was the cabin? I mean,
A double cabin, I think, and not would have been under normal circumstances. It was quite a large cabin, being a double one. So, and the bunks, there must have been four cabin, because one was one on top of each side. So the four, and then two of us had to sleep on the floor. We had, and we took it in turns, so the chaps weren't always on the floor. They had a go on the more comfortable. Berths, and we got on quite well together. And
what was the food like?
Not too bad, and we were able to get a drink too. And it was better than I'd anticipated, I must say. And eventually,
now were you seasick, or was that not a problem?
No, I've never been seasick. Never even felt seasick. I've been on board some of these boats for quite a long time.
So where were you going? You were going to Freetown, weren't you?
Yes. And all us 20 pilots were dropped off at Freetown. And then there was a coastal boat, a Nigerian, and or was it? You see, Freetown, it may have been from Freetown, I think. And they took us round. We were in a couple of days in Freetown, and they took us round the coast, round to Lagos. And it took about...
That's Nigeria, is it?
Yes. It took about 4 days.
And this is in August by now, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, because you set off on the 27th of July, so yes, it must be August. So what were your first impressions of what you... Because you were going to a transit camp at Lagos, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, well, first of all, in that boat going round the coast, boy, it was dreadful. It was operated by black people. The boat was filthy. The food was dreadful, and the fleas it was dreadful. We didn't even bother to take our clothes off. So we got to Lagos after about 4 days. We were thundering glad to get ashore and get off that boat. And then they put us into a transit camp.
And what was the transit camp like?
Oh, well, not too bad. And It was run by the, it was an RAF transit camp. And we were there. Must have been there for about the best part of 2 weeks, I should think. We were waiting for an aircraft to pick us up, to take us to Cairo.
You seem to have quite enjoyed your time in Lagos. Local hospitality, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Now, who's that? Is this the British
yes.
colonial?
Yes, yes. I know there was a manager from Barclays Bank. There was one or two chaps who'd been established out there for quite a long time. And they had some nice houses. And they were very happy to invite us chaps in for a little supper and drinks, because it broke the boredom of their own way of life. And it was very good. We used to sit out on the balcony and talk away and have a few drinks with them. It was really quite pleasant.
Now, what about the Dakota when that arrived?
Well, when that arrived, we all clambered aboard, and that took us to Cairo. And
anything about the flight? It's quite unusual, that's for a long distance flight, then.
I've just got to see if I've got to see. I don't know if I made any notes of it in here or not. Oh, yes, here we are. It was.
What was the date of it? When
did you, it took us the 2nd, 3rd and 4th of September. And we went from Lagos to Kano. Kano was up in the north of Nigeria. And then we went from Kano across to Maiduguri, north, right in the far northeastern corner of Nigeria. And then the next day, we had a night stop there. We went to a place called El Janena, which is in the area where this Darfur business is now. And then we went from El Janena to Khartoum. And the next day, we went from Khartoum to Cairo. And in that DC-3, it took six hours and 10 minutes.
Well, what was it like travelling in the Dakota? Was it comfortable enough, or was it...
Transport. No, no, just sat down the sides, had side bench seats, and it wasn't very comfortable. But nevertheless, they got us there.
Now, who were you posted to? You'd gone out as an individual. Who were you going to join?
I didn't know at the time. We had to report to the headquarters in Cairo, and then they told us where we had to go, and
You go to 33 Squadron, don't you?
Sorry?
You go to 33 Squadron.
Yes, that's right, yes.
So you're joining 33 Squadron, you?
Yes, landed at Cairo from Dakota on the 4th of September. Then we had to go and check in at headquarters in Cairo, the air headquarters, and eventually I was posted to number 33 Squadron, and I was there.
That's part of 243 Wing.
Yes, that's right. 30th. About the 30th of September was my first day there, I think.
Now, where were they based?
I was 23rd of September. I went to 243 Wing. I went to 243 Wing, that was it. And within that wing, there were three Hurricane Squadrons. No, four. It was number 33... 238, number one South African Squadron, and another one,
213.
Yes.
Now, where were you based? Because you seem to, it's got a number.
LG-85 was the first one I went to.
And where was that near? Or was it near nowhere?
Well, by this time, because the line had been set at Alamein, because Montgomery had also just arrived out there at about this time. And, you know, in that part of Egypt, from the Mediterranean coast down to the what they call the Qatara Depression was about 30 miles, and that was the length of the Alamein line at that time.
So how far behind the Alamein line were you?
About 10 miles.
So quite close. So
oh, yes.
You call it El Alamein area. And
yeah.
And it was landing ground 154.
Yes, from...
Now, what was the name?
Early October.
What
so
was landing ground 154? I mean...
it's just a bit of desert. Where they'd it'd been smoothed over, where we could operate hurricanes.
Now, how did they smooth the desert out? I mean, was it flattened by something, or...?
No, I think they just ran some vehicles over back and forth and just so levelled any bumps and things. That's all they could do. It didn't make runways or anything like that.
Now, what were you living in?
We were living in ridge tents. And we used to sink these ridge tents into the ground, about 4 or 5 feet, so that if we were strafed, we would be below the ground level when we were sleeping. Although the top of the tent might have been above, so we were protected to that extent if there was any strafing.
Now, what was it like in those tents in the desert? Was it very hot in there? Or
oh, yes.
What was it like?
Yes. Oh, it was very hot out there, even in October. This was early October. Yes. But there were two of us to a tent, officers. And we had our camp beds. And
now, what about the food? And I'm going to do the conditions. We'll go on to the operations next time, I think.
Yes.
Yes. What was the food like in it? I mean, it was cooked. How?
It was mainly bully beef, in various forms. Sometimes it was bully beef stew, bully beef fritters, anything you could do with bully beef. All they tried to vary it, but it was always bully beef. Tins of it, you see.
Did you get fed up of it, or...?
No, not really. It wasn't too bad. The chaps tried their best to vary the presentation of it.
And what would you get with the bully beef?
I think it was mainly tins of beans. I just can't... We didn't get any fresh vegetables or anything like that.
So not what you call now a healthy diet?
No, not really. No, not.
And what about water supply and how,
yes.
How you get it? I mean, would you get it as tea or...?
We had vehicles with big water tanks on, and that's where we got out, because... if we didn't drink the water as such, it was always boiled. Never drank it.
Was there enough water?
We had to go carefully with it, because, you know, particularly if you wanted to wash, you didn't have buckets full. You had to really conserve the water and just... You didn't have any bathing facilities, of course. So
how would you wash?
We had, these camp little things on four legs, and there's a canvas. It was about that deep. About
4 or 5 inches.
Yes, about that size. And that's where we did all our washing.
Were you expected to shave as well?
More or less. I always used to, apart from when we were out in the Later on, we went to a landing valve where we didn't get much water, so I didn't shave there for 4 days. But I used to shave, yeah.
Now, what about latrines?
Oh, all out in the open. They dig trenches and put a wooden seat on top with a hole in it. And that was a latrine. I've got a good photograph of me sitting on one.
They had a supply of paper and things, that's a, you know.
Yes, but it was pretty crude. But nevertheless, we...
Now, what about the climate? How quickly did you acclimatise to it? You've had a bit of time in Lagos, but I mean... Why
yes.
Did you settle in?
Well, then I had a best part of... I was just looking here. From the time I arrived in Cairo, it was on the 4th of September, I went to my squadron on the 30th of September, so probably would have been there the day before. But
did it take you long to get used to the climate?
No, not really. We were living in Cairo in a transit office there, run by a chap who was a brother of the well-known film star, Arthur Howard, his name was. And do you remember the film star, Michael Howard?
Leslie
Howard, that's right, was his brother. Was running this transit camp in Cairo.
So you got used to the climate.
It wasn't a transit camp. It was they took over a huge flat in a big block of flats.
So you got used to the climate there.
Yes.
Didn't have any problem with the heat then.
No.
Were you warned to stay out of the sun, not to get sunburned, not to get heat stroke, that kind of thing?
Oh yes, yes. You had to use common sense. Yeah. But it didn't worry me at all. I don't mind the hot weather. It's the cold weather I don't like.
And what about when you got there? One of the things that there were there that is sandstorms. Can you just tell me about that?
Oh.
You had a particularly bad one, I think, quite early on.
Yes, yes. It lasted for about 2, maybe 3 days. And
what was it like? I mean, people can't imagine what it was like.
Oh, you can't, you can't see any further than that wall, for instance.
Away. 4 or 5 feet,
yeah, 6 feet. Yeah. Oh, and it used to get it in your hair and everywhere. It's all this sand in the air. And that was dreadful.
Would it get in your tent?
Well, we used to keep the flaps closed. And so that stopped it getting in the tent. But it was... It was just about everywhere, really. It was incredible. And impossible to do any flying or anything at all. I mean, it was as thick as that.
Now, you were flying Hurricanes again. And this
yes.
time it's Mark 2Cs.
That's right.
Now, what did you think? Again, it's not so much... What was different about it? What was better?
Well, it had a better engine in than the Marks... Of Hurricane I had flown in France, and also the armament was better because it had 2 cannons and 4 machine guns, and of course it was had these proper fittings for desert flying. It had a special radiator, a bigger one for cooling, and trying to think what else they had.
Did they have special filters?
Yes, they did.
And did they work? I mean, it's quite difficult keeping things, sensitive engines going in the desert.
Yes,
I just
they were fine. Yeah, they used to go well.
So the filters, any problem with them clogging up or anything? Or?
No, I don't remember any problems with the filters.
And so this, how did the 2C compare with the Spitfire then? I mean, was it now as fast or more?
No,
the Spitfire moved on as well in the time.
Yes, yes. No, it never came quite as fast as the Spitfire, but it was a good aeroplane, the old Hurricane, especially for desert use, because it had this wide undercarriage, bigger wheels, and for operating off these rough desert strips, there was nothing more than that. I mean, they weren't prepared. So, and being tow-heavy, you had a better view. So, for desert operations, under the desert conditions that were at that time, the Hurricane was really a better aircraft than the Spitfire, mainly because it was so much better on the ground. Once you got them in the air, of course, the Spitfire then was slightly better again.
You flew with the hoods open. Can you tell me why? And what was it like flying with the hoods open?
Yes.
Was it not a bit windy?
Well, it was warm. It wasn't cold. So, yes, we used to tuck in behind the windscreen. But
why did you do that?
Because with the Hurricane canopy, it wasn't one single canopy, it was in panels. And it, with the strong sunlight, the vision that was not very good. So it was better vision for looking out for any other aircraft in there, enemy aircraft in particular. You got a better vision with the canopy back.
Was there also a part of it that it was quicker to get out? You were flying at lower altitudes, weren't you? Also to make getting out quicker, or is that not really part? Was it really the vision thing? Because
No, the reason we didn't do any really high altitude stuff out there. Occasionally went up 20,000 maybe, but most of our patrol work was done about 10,000 feet, and particularly when we were trying to protect the army.
So is that why you had the hood? Another reason you had the hoods open to allow you to parrot to get out.
Well,
that's what the book seems to imply. It doesn't mention it.
Yes, it did make it easier to get out, of course.
That's not really what.
That wasn't really the aim of the.
The reason was visibility.
Visibility, yes. Yeah.
The other thing is, what was flying kit in the desert? Can you just describe what you'd wear? And then we'll go to operation.
We always wore long trousers. Protection in case of any fire, rather than having shorts. We used to wear shorts when we weren't flying, but if we were flying, we always wore long trousers, and we always had our sleeves down and done up at the cuff on our shirts. We didn't have any flying kit apart from our helmets.
So it'd just be a normal shirt?
Yes, yeah.
What about that scarf? When did you start wearing scarves, or had you always done silk scarves?
No, not we didn't wear them in the desert.
So you didn't wear them in the desert, right?
No.